Welcome to the New Zealand Tech Podcast, presented by Paul Spain, Bradley Burrows, and guests.
Welcome to the NZ Tech Podcast. This is episode number 52. This is our special wrap-up of the Consumer Electronics Show 2012 that took place in Vegas over the last few days. I'm very pleased to be back in the studio with Brad and Skip. How are you doing, guys?
Good. Welcome back. You look tired, jet-lagged, sore, but good.
Yeah, feeling good. It's great to be back. It really was an amazing week, and there were just so many things that happened. So I hope we can capture a little bit of the essence of some of those extra elements of CES that we haven't covered on the previous shows. Of course, episode 49 was our first episode, covering some of the smaller startups and some of the early activities and interviews that I covered at CES in Vegas. Episode 50 was our usual Tuesday night show that was sort of recorded remote, and of course we had episode 51 covering the opening and the first full day on the show floor of activities, and this wrap up show we'll cover the remainder. So yeah, it should be a good one.
Now, I'd just like to say, Paul, you've done a remarkable job for the one man show that you have been over there effectively. And I don't know how you managed to get half these interviews.
Yeah, I honestly, Skip and I have been back in the New Zealand studio here just listening to hours and hours of Paul Spain interviews, and you've had some absolute stunning interviews.
Oh, now, no, don't forget the emails we've been getting. Oh, I just met with so-and-so.
I know.
I mean, it's been like a flood of name-dropping.
It is.
It's been incredible.
So you have your TMZ websites with Isis or Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie, and our geek world of podcasting, it's been, I've just seen Leah Laporte and we're like, oh my goodness. So you've done awfully well for yourself.
It was a good time. I think, you know, any event like this, there are going to be there are going to be so many people, and there are so many things to see. Very, very hard to work out actually how to balance your time, what things to look at, what things to go to. But, you know, I think, you know, the result is we've managed to connect with some interesting people, and, you know, I hope the shows have ended up being a good mix of content that our listeners, you know, have come to enjoy, and that this is, you know, something maybe we can do again in the future. But it was definitely worthwhile going and being a part of CES rather than just sort of looking at it online, because I often say sometimes you can actually report better on event not being there, being able to catch all the things online because of all the running around that you actually do being at the event in person. But in this case, I have to say it was well worth being there on the show floor and a lot of those sort of one-off events and so on.
I don't think the New Zealand media would have got a lot of the startup and the smaller crowd information that we got over the last couple of podcasts if it wasn't for someone like you actually going there and digging around. So I think it's been hugely beneficial for us to go and explore. I mean, I've found companies that I'm actually hooking up with just to see what they do. I mean, there's just been some great information come through. So, Paul, great job. And on top of it, you were also sick on one of the days as well. So I think International Trooper of the Year award goes to you.
Oh, well, thanks very much for that. I mean, I have covered a lot of events in the US in the past over the years in various forms. You know, a lot of them in previous years with worlddj.com covering things like the Winter Music Conference in Miami. So I'm used to the crazy hours and just, you know, so many things going on. But, you know, I mean, this was the most unusual event, just the sheer size of it, having that 150,000 or so people there on the ground for it, and just so many things going on. So, yep, loved it. Now, let's dive in and chat through some of the other things that we saw and jump into the interviews as well. So the first interview we're going to feature, this is with Sean Cassidy from Sony, and I spent a lot of time looking at CES around what was happening in the TV space. Now, we had Samsung, of course, who was showing off their OLED screens. Now, this is the technology that we've seen really in our smartphones, that's now scaled up to full-size TV. So that, you know, we talk about these super AMOLED screens, and this is a variant that, that the best and the brightest smartphones have, particularly from Samsung. And, you know, what we saw from Samsung was that, you know, they've scaled that up to the 55-inch type size now. Beautiful, beautiful screens. But now we're gonna, yeah, we're gonna dive into this interview with Sony. We talk a little bit about some of their technology, and they had some technology demos on display of products that aren't out yet, and that was cool to see in person. Right, across to this discussion with Sean Cassidy. We're just looking at the new Crystal LED display. It's a 55-inch display. Sean, tell us a little bit about this and when this is available.
Well, what's really nice about Crystal LED is this. You know, when we talk about LCD and other products, we talk about, you know, substrates and panels and color filters and layers. This is a straight LED product. It's a true LED product. So it takes 2 million pixels, right, to make 1920 by 1080. So if we were to pull the front off of this, by the way, what do you think of the picture?
Yeah, it's pretty impressive.
Impressive. It's very gorgeous. So if I were to pull the front off of this, you would actually see 6 million LEDs. We have a red, a green, and a blue LED for each pixel. So what does that mean? Wide color gamut. It looks natural. Because the LEDs themselves are creating the image, now response time is in microseconds. It's very, very fast. So when you see fast motion, it's going to be crisp, it's going to be clear, it's going to be lifelike, there's not going to be artifacting, judder. So it's a beauty unto itself in that way. And then, of course, when we talk about contrast, it's LED technology. We can turn those pixels off to get black, but yet we can still keep detail. You know, there's nothing worse than crushed black. You might as well not be watching it at all if it's crushing black. So this is going to give you the best contrast. It's going to give you the best brightness, the best energy efficiency, color the works. We'll be able to eventually make it in very large sizes. It's a technology display at the moment. It's not a product, but that's kind of what we come to CES for, right? To see stuff way before everybody else does. And that way, when it comes out, we're like, yeah, I already saw that. So this is really where what the engineers, they're wrapping their minds around as far as all, you know, coming attractions for technology for television.
Well, that's pretty impressive. So you're talking about 6 million LEDs in there. Is that right? That just is pretty hard to fathom, actually.
Yeah, 6 million LEDs, when they told me, it's like, I'd love to see it. I mean, the scope of that is mind-numbing, yeah. It'll smash your brain, yeah. It's awesome.
Cool. That's really cool. Now, across from here, you've got the also the demos of the 46-inch glasses-free 3D TV. That stuff's looking pretty cool as well. Is that far off from market? What's the situation with glasses-free TV from Sony?
We're still looking at a technology demonstration. You know, people, that's one of their big inquiries with 3D is, when are we going to be able to do it without glasses? Now, we make products with glasses that makes a beautiful picture, but if that's what the customer wants, we're working on it. So again, it's still a technology display. What you're looking at when we're over there is a 4K panel, and then to do 3D without glasses, it's 1920 by 1080. So yeah, we're kind of giving people a glimpse into what's next in 3D for Sony.
Yeah, I mean, that's just the one I looked at there. It seemed to operate a little bit better than one of the other ones that we had a look at here on the show floor. Maybe a little bit of a headache, but I think you'd probably have to use it a bit longer to know whether that was just that I was tired from walking the show floor or not, or whether there are some technology hoops to jump through there, I suppose.
Oh, well, you know, it all depends. Again, it could be, I've stood in front of it all day and stared at it, and so far, no problems. You know, we make 3D. Sony isn't just a TV company, a Blu-ray company, a headphone company, a camera company. We make the movies in 3D. We make 3D games. And we also have, in partnership with two other companies, we have 3Net, which is our own 3D TV network. So, yeah, we know how to make 3D look great. And that's a big step towards glassless.
Cool. We'll look forward to seeing that one come through. And yeah, pretty impressed also with the glasses free 3D Vio demo there as well, with the face tracking
the
and so on.
Yeah, that's very, very cool. Yeah, I'm not the computer guy, but I tell you right now, that impressed the heck out of me. I was watching it. It does a really good job of tracking. And, you know, there's a lot of 3D content on the internet. There's a lot of 3D content. If you have an all-in-one piece like that where you can throw a Blu-ray player in it, you might as well have it in your computer as well, you know. Again, you're helping me out here. Again, that's the 3D story of Sony. We touch every part of 3D, including in our Vio computers.
Cool. All right. Well, thanks very much for your time, Sean. Anything else that we should be looking out for?
Well, you know, we have a new pair of 3D glasses. You were talking about glassless 3D, and one of the some people say that the glasses are kind of heavy. So we've created these new glasses, and I know this is audio, and I'm holding them up, so you can't see them. But if you go online, you can see them. They weigh about an ounce and a half. When I give them to people, they're like, oh, you've gone passive. And they get very, very freaked out when we show them that this is an active pair of glasses that only weighs 1.4 ounces. It's made out of titanium, so it's strong, it's light, and it's hypoallergenic. All the electronics are in the front. So you can bend the arms, and like some of my competitors, you bend the arms, you're ruining some of their electronics. So far, I think the sexiest 3D glasses I've seen in two. So
yeah, you'd be right on that one. They're definitely the best looking 3D glasses around at the moment.
And they're universal. So if you you can adjust them for children. They come with two nose pieces, and if they're USB charged, so five minutes on a charge will give you 3 hours. 40 minutes will give you about 15 hours of viewing or 7 movies. So yeah, no, this is so until glassless comes out, this is the way to do 3D.
Excellent. All right, well, thanks for your time. That's great. Cheers.
Cheers. Thanks, and enjoy the rest of the show.
Thank you. Brad, you would have actually really enjoyed looking at this stuff, because I know you enjoy the top end TV stuff and visual things. And the 3D that I saw, and the TV, and also the 3D glasses free PC that I saw from Sony there, there was definitely some of the best TV type tech that was on show at CES. Now, I guess when we look at the overall sort of view on glasses free 3D, I would say that it's not quite there yet. And in fact, you know, Sony were even saying that, look, this with the bulk of that technology, they were saying, hey, this is just preview technology, we're not launching it. Some of the other vendors did show us products that are launching this year, and some of it was really poor, actually, I have to say. And so, yeah, it was good to have that chat. One of the things I think you would have really liked was the Vio PC, which was 3D glasses free with the eye tracking. So yeah, you can move around in front of it, no glasses, and it worked pretty well. And that's actually coming to market this year, I believe.
Yeah, I think the crystal LED stuff sounds really interesting for me. I've read a little bit about that stuff before. And I think where they're going with getting, was it 2 million pixels behind the
2 million individual LEDs
behind the screen.
You know, rather than the traditional where you've got your big, panel, and then you've got, you know, LEDs maybe providing the backlighting for it, is actually every pixel is an LED itself, which is... it's a pretty hard concept to get your head around, actually, having, if the viewers don't understand that, it's like having an actual individual light bulb per pixel, which, yeah, with 2 million pixels on a screen, that's crazy.
Yeah, and I mean, we were talking about this off air, is that it really comes to a point where the picture quality becomes so crisp that you can't unless you line them up next to each other, it's really hard to pick them apart. So, but it's, look, this is good for the consumer. This is going to be ultra thin, ultra light devices coming through. I think some of the devices that you were twittering about to me were like 4 or 5 millimeters thick or something silly like that. So yeah, I'm looking forward to this stuff coming out.
Yeah, the new Samsung their new OLED screen, that was razor thin. That was amazing. And I guess it has to be when you think of it. It's really a scaled up cell phone display, and those things have got to be thin by their nature. When you think of, you know, your cell phones are often under a centimeter thick, including batteries and all the other electronics. So yeah, cool stuff. Now, one of the other ones that I had a look at, and this company hasn't got much coverage, is we looked at product from Stream TV Networks, and they're an independent company, not one of the big TV manufacturers, that have been developing their own 3D screen technology that, again, is glasses free. And this one was quite different to all of the rest that I saw. Now, I would say still, in my opinion, it's a long way off from what you'll get with glasses. But their story was that this is launching, you know, globally in I think the next few months. And yeah, listen to the discussion. We'll jump into that now with Matthew Rudkin.
What our team has done is we've developed a glasses-free 3D without glasses, and we have addressed all the issues with 3D without glasses. We think it is very competitive with 3D with the glasses, and we have fixed all the problems, things like viewing angles, loss of resolution, and depth perception. So we give a great viewing experience to the consumer. We have a 42-inch and a 55-inch TV with a converter box that it's coming out in Q2 that you're going to see all over the world, and it will allow you to convert all your 2D content into 3D without glasses, as well as 3D with glasses into 3D without glasses. And we call the technology Ultra D, and we think we've sort of set a new standard for 3D without glasses. And the first products you'll see are television sets, then you're going to see PCs, laptops, tablets, even phones with our technology. And we'll have like a movie download site as well as an app store, so you can buy content and watch it on your devices as well.
Wow, so that's quite a broad spread you're aiming for there. Now, your situation is quite unique because your technology does seem to be quite different to what the mainstream television manufacturers and electronic companies are releasing, and you know, in terms of the Sonys and Samsungs and the like. How are you geared up to be able to sort of spread yourselves across into that tablet and mobile phone space and so on? Have you got partners sort of lined up?
Yep, we're going to be making announcements over the next few weeks and months of different partners around the world who are helping us to distribute these amazing products. We've teamed up with some multi-billion-dollar companies that are absolutely gigantic and have worldwide reach, and so you'll be seeing a lot of announcements. But we've sort of leapfrogged the Sonys and the Apples and the Samsungs of the world, and we think we're way ahead of everybody else, and we think this is really going to change all the categories and all the devices, and we think it's going to replace not only 3D with the glasses, but it's even going to replace 2D as well.
Interesting. Yeah, well, certainly having a look at the prototypes you've got on display here, which I understand are handmade. They're certainly pretty capable, and that comment about being able to view from multiple angles is correct. Is there any way you can sort of put into simple terms how the technology works for our listeners?
Yeah, we've developed a set of algorithms that basically take, you know, we'll say a two-dimensional image, and then makes a calculation as to what images should be in the front and what images should be in the back. Whereas a lot of the technology, such as 3D with the glasses, they create a left and right image and rotate it very fast to sort of trick your brain into seeing 3D when it's really not there. So we basically mimic the way your natural eye works, and that way it's very comfortable to watch our content. You can watch movies all day long and not get dizzy or tired or overwhelmed, and you're going to find that you prefer this over watching a regular 2D video.
All right, well, thanks very much for your time, Matthew. Enjoyed hearing about what Stream TV's doing with Ultra D. That's great. Thank you.
All right, thanks a lot.
All right. That was good to hear a little bit from Stream TV Networks. Now, yeah, just to conclude that, my experience of their 3D was that it seemed to work from, you know, it wasn't, you had to be in a direct specific location. I struggled to actually get my head around how their technology works. But it works quite well. What it doesn't give you, compared to with glasses, is the things that really jump off the screen. But in terms of the depth, almost seems like it's, you know, you can see things more in the distance. You can tell that they're in the distance, but the things that get really close to you, It's not so well tuned for that. That would be my impression of that one, Brad.
Yeah, look, from what I read online and been able to sort of research, again, the depth perception, like you said, is the big problem. I mean, with the glasses, you're going to get that feeling that things are going to hit you in the face, whereas this one's almost like looking, you know those paintings that you look at and you get a little bit of depth going through them? That's what I sort of get the impression it's going to be like. Mm. It's not full 3D, but you are getting some 3D niche, if you like, yeah, around it.
The other thing about this, and you know, it did highlight that the panels that were on display had all been handmade, so there were some difficulties with them, but they didn't seem to have the resolution of a lot of the other panels, which were going to four times the resolution of a normal HD screen. So these new 4K screens, as they're calling them, which are eight. Million pixels,
scary.
So, yeah. Hey, interesting space. It's great to see some of these products are coming to market. But you know, I'll leave it up to our listeners when the products do land in New Zealand to give their opinion. But you know, I would say don't have high expectations at this stage. Yep. And I certainly won't be the first to sign up and buy one. Now, after chatting with the Stream TV guys, there were a number of interviews we did, and we've tried to cull out those that weren't so interesting. But one of the products I found was a panoramic camera from Tomago. So we're going to dive in there and chat to Stefan from Tomago.
Tomago is basically a world first. It's the first compact camera that can take 360 images in one click. So it's a little device that's egg-shaped, hence the name. Tomago means egg in Japanese. And it's an extremely simple device, but it does a lot. It has a position sensor inside, so if you're oriented pointing up, it'll take a 360 image, and if you shoot in front of you, it'll take a 180 panorama in one click. That means you could be skiing down a mountain and you'll get a panoramic image of you skiing on that mountain instead of having to pan and scan like most companies do now.
That's pretty cool. Now, with that image, I can imagine that can be a bit confusing in terms of how you view it. Have you got some software tools that allow you to sort of create that big, long landscape-type view?
Yeah, well, the software and the applications is all integrated with the Tomago. It works on any platform, Android, iOS, any computer platform, PC, Mac, whatever. And it's all seamlessly integrated. So with the Tomago, you can basically take a picture, it'll wirelessly send the file to your iPhone, for example, and you can browse, zoom, pan on your phone or on your computer or any device.
What sort of connectivity does the device have? Is it a USB type connection?
Well, you can connect it three ways. There's a Wi-Fi chip, Bluetooth, and if you want to hardwire it, there's a micro USB at the back of it.
Well, so it's got three connectivity options. That's pretty good for a device that's coming in at, what is it, about $200?
Yeah, we aim to sell it at a retail price of under $200.
Great. When is it coming to market, and what markets is it going to be available in?
It's coming to market end of Q2 this year, and basically the market is the general consumer market. It's the aim of this product is to bring the ability to everyone to do panoramic images very simply, and there's no stitching, no complicated software. It's just you click, have a picture, and you can share it on Facebook, you can or any other social media, and it's simple.
Cool. What sort of resolution is it coming in at?
The image is 14 megapixels, so it's a very good resolution for a $200 device.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, that looks good. Do you think there'll be a video-type option coming down the track over the next year or two?
Most certainly, yes. We're planning on having a video version for next year.
Cool. All right, well, we'll look out for that, and thanks very much for that, Stefan.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Cool. Neat product. There actually is a whole lot going on in this panoramic space. That was really just one of the many products that were at CES. Some of the other things that I saw were at the startup event that I covered on the Sunday evening, I saw an app that runs on the iPad. And what you do is you have to first of all build a panoramic image, and they've got software to help you with that. And then you can hold your iPad, and depending on the direction or the tilt of your iPad, the iPad is virtually a window into a panoramic image. So
is it like Photosynth? What Photosynth sort of does, but a bit more sort of
but gyroscope. Perfectly smooth, yeah. And with a gyroscope. So you imagine if you were standing in a dome, you know, you look up, you're going to see the sky. You look out, you're going to see, let's say you're at a beach, you're going to see the sand and you're going to see the water in front of you. And you look down, you're just going to see the sand, right? And it works like that. You tilt your iPad in a downward direction, and in one case it was a beach image, as though you were in paradise somewhere on a lovely island, and you pointed the iPad down, you look down on it, and yeah, it's a sand, and you just move it around, and it was absolutely smooth, flawless, beautiful. Tilted up, you could see the sky and the palm trees and so on, and they had different, you know, images and so on that you could go through. But yeah, quite an interesting concept. They've got some interesting ideas on how they might commercialize this for real estate and other things. But yeah, it was fun.
It's like Google View on steroids almost, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there are already ways that you can take those sort of views, but having it so you actually angle the device and so on was fun. From a practical sort of sense, is that how you're going to want to operate if you wanted to look around something? No, you'd probably actually want to do it on a still screen.
Yeah.
But it did have a bit of a cool factor to it. So
you got geeked in by it, you did.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. Whether that would last longer than, you know, the 3 or 4 minutes, or maybe it was 1 or 2 minutes that I played with it. Yeah, maybe not. But hey. But good to see these new ideas coming through anyway.
Yeah, now one of the next interviews that you did was with Kathy from the Cubify Systems. Now, this, when I listened to this interview and you did it, I could not believe some of the rendering time that she mentions in this interview. It's like 40 hours to render these 3D images, if you like. And that's just a phenomenal amount of effort that goes through. And she said there's got to be a warm-up, a cool-down time. And, you know, they use them in the F-18 Hornets as well to do the 3D modelling and stuff.
Make some of those one-off pieces.
It's incredible.
And so on. Yeah, it's very cool. Yeah, this is the chat with Kathy Lewis from talking about Cubify.
Yes, what we've launched in Cubify.com is really a mashup of iTunes and Facebook, where the consumer can go and become a member for free and begin to create and make in 3D, almost like a coloring book canvas. To support that activity, we're bringing in apps developers who will be able to merchandise their designs and their capabilities, along with artists and creatives that will be able to sell their models. Once a consumer actually has a model that they want to print, we're going to help them get to the finished physical product a couple ways. There's the cloud printing service where they can upload their file and say, can you print this for me? And we can print it in full color, we can print it clear, we can print it in a single color, anything the consumer wants at almost any size. As they become more comfortable with their own 3D printing capabilities, then they can bring Cube home with them. Cube is right here in front of us, and it is $1,299. That includes the cartridge of material, which will print somewhere between 10 to 12 average size models. We're also including with the Cube the ability to have 50 free downloaded files. The minute you initialize the Cube, we'll send you files so you know how to print. And each replacement cartridge will be $49.95, and again, you can print 10 to 12 to 15 different models in a color of your choice.
Well, that sounds fairly groundbreaking in terms of price point. Now, that's a very low-end device. Obviously, the sorts of things that you're talking about in terms of full color and varying sizes and so on requires some much more expensive equipment. What is the sort of price range from this one at what comes in probably under $2,000 New Zealand? What's the sort of the higher end in terms of hardware that you need to use to produce people's output?
Well, as 3D Systems, we invented 3D printing 25 years ago, and the very first technology was called stereolithography, fondly referred to today as SLA. An SLA machine, fully configured, double wide, that can print a complete automotive dashboard in a single print, will run you up to $1 million. Okay. In between, we've got these selective laser sintering machines that do amazing output, and those run some from $250,000 to about $750,000. For the professional in their offices, we have a whole range of machines that start at about $10,000 and go up to about $200,000. So right now, we're breaking glass with this $1,299 machine. But behind the scenes on Cubify.com, you have access to all seven technologies that 3D Systems has brought to the market. And that's our goal, to get the consumer close to whatever they need, whenever they need it, and not have them be constrained by content or the product in their homes.
Great. Now, you're US-based. As far as the international market's concerned, how does that operate? Can people upload and still get things sent, or do you have places, you know, outside of the US you can do the output?
Thank you for asking that question, because today, 25 years into our business, over 50% of our income and revenue comes from outside the United States. So rest of world is very, very important to us. We have production facilities, we have distribution partners, we have installations all over the globe, and we're continuing to extend our footprint so that we're always able to supply to the consumer and the professional alike 24/7.
That's very cool. Excellent. Oh, thanks very much for your time, Kathy. One last question. How long does it actually take to produce these 3D things? I'm sure it varies according to their complexity and so on, but what are the various sort of time lengths from the $1,299 consumer device, what it can output up to some of the bigger things that you were talking about?
You know, the funny thing about this is when you have your own printer at home, your average model is going to be 1 to 2 hours. With the heavy-duty printers, sometimes we'll be printing for 40 hours straight to do a model, and in some cases, there's an additional period of time for it to cool or get prepared. So it's interesting where we've been able to take our knowledge and make it faster and simpler in the home than what we do on a professional basis. But I kid you not, the kinds of things that we build at 3D Systems have changed the world for mankind. Customized hearing aids, new ways of straightening your teeth, 98 things that are inside a F-18 fighter jet right now that are printed and put into the jet for takeoff. You name it, we've printed it, and our goal is to continue to support both the on-demand end-use parts model as well as the consumer opportunity.
Right. That was fun looking at all sorts of stuff that they've built with their 3D printers, and cool that you can actually now just, you know, send them in and get things made up. There have been a few companies in New Zealand that have delved into this space. I'm not sure what's available now, but I know Neville Newcomb in Auckland, who do the printing, copying, reprographics, and so on. They got into, as well as their printing on paper and big A1 prints, all that sort of stuff, into actually 3D printing for a while. I think what they found was there wasn't a huge demand here in New Zealand for it, but I imagine the likes of these new offerings like Cubify with quite low pricing open this sort of stuff up to a broader market. Now, here in my bag, Brad, I'll just pull it out. I've got little toy that I brought back, which has been made up. And it was cool just to see some of the little gadgets and bits and pieces, everything from keyring holders through to there were all sorts of little bits and pieces, and it's worth looking these guys up online to have a look at the stuff. And this one I'm showing is just plain white, and most of the cheaper things that you can get built for you are just a single color. But if you're willing to spend enough money, these guys will make up all sorts of 3D 3D things for you, so kind of cool.
And they're not just based; they do actually ship internationally. In the interview, Kathy talks about how I think it's 20 or 25% of her business is coming from worldwide now, which is really interesting. That it's obviously starting to grow outside the US, which is good to see.
Yeah. Now there was. As I mentioned earlier, there were a lot of interviews that we did during CES, and we're certainly leaving some of them out of the podcast because I guess one of the challenges with going to a show like CES is in most cases you end up finding yourself talking to a PR person that just likes to talk about their product and doesn't, they don't always have anything useful to say. They did vary. So what I'd like to do now is to jump into interview that we did with Ryan McGee from Ford Research. And you know, Ryan's got quite a different role. He's not a day-to-day PR guy. He's actually one of the guys out of their R&D labs. So it was a real privilege to get to chat with Ryan. And yeah, thanks very much to the Ford New Zealand guys for helping connect me with Ford in the US and getting this exclusive chat with Ryan.
I'm based out of Dearborn, Michigan, which is right outside of Detroit. And the area that I work in is Ford's research and advanced engineering activity. So I'm really working on what's next, 3 to 5, 10 years out, thinking about the future and trying to come up with solutions.
Wow, that's really cool. Well, you know, we've seen some interesting things on your stand. Can you tell us a little bit about, I guess, what are the current things that Ford has in your newest cars and in the EVOS concept car that we were just looking at on the stand? And then from that, maybe we can go on and hear about some of the things that are a little bit further out.
Sure. Some of the things we have here today, this week at CES, is the Focus electric vehicle, just going on sale. It's a pretty fantastic car. My background is actually in electrified vehicles, so I'm particularly passionate about that car. It also comes with connectivity built into the car, so you can use your mobile device to monitor charging, to open the doors, and so on. On the other side of the booth, we have what's called AppLink. And AppLink is an extension of our Sync technology. The Sync technology allows you to talk to your car. And AppLink takes it to a next level, where we're opening up the system to allow other people to write applications for the vehicle. So Stitcher, NPR, Pandora all have apps that run inside the car. Those are two of the main things. The other thing is we're talking about is an upgrade to our MyFord Touch system. Our MyFord Touch system is how users interact with their car through a touch screen, and the new software we're upgrading this year will help improve that.
Great. Now, you mentioned about mobile phones being able to open the doors and so on, and one of the vehicles that I tried recently, you'd just walk up to the car with a key in your pocket and it would know and you could open the door. How will that differ? Will it mean you won't need a key at all? Can you tell us about how that works?
Yeah, so I drive an Explorer. I have that kind of technology where I just keep the key in my pocket, and when I touch the door, it opens. That's pretty cool. But what this can do is let's say you lock your keys in the car. This is a way that you can say, open my car right now. So it's kind of taking it to a new level.
Okay, that's cool. Now, you talked about MyFord Touch 2, and there's also Ford Sync. Where do those two products sort of sit, and what are the differences?
Sure. So Sync's been out for a few years now, and the Sync system is a way for you to make phone calls using your voice. You can find MP3s using your voice. So it's really a way of interacting with your car that allows you to keep your eyes on the road and your hands on the wheel. That's our main strategy there. MyFord Touch is more recent, the last year or two, where it's a set of LCD screens that the user can use to interact with climate control, navigation, entertainment like radio, and then also the user's phone. So it's a system that is a way that we interface with the customer. Sync gives you the audio, and MyFord Touch gives you that the tactile.
Okay, nice. Now, yeah, tell us a little bit more about what's coming up, and what we should expect to see coming through from the labs.
Thanks. So I think maybe we can start with the Ford EVOS concept, which is the showpiece of our booth here, and it's just total eye candy. Red Hot Chili's its color. The paint is deep. It's beautiful, but it's not just about design. It's about technology. And we're using that as a way to talk about our technology story. And that's what I'm really passionate about is, you know, what's going to come next? What's the new technology? And there's three areas where we're highlighting this week. One is about vehicle-to-vehicle communication, where two vehicles can talk to each other to improve safety. The second piece is health and wellness. How can the car help manage your health and wellness? Because let's face it, people are in their cars more and more every day, and it's becoming a place where maybe we can use that time to help people interact with their health and wellness management systems. And then the third piece is a cloud connected car. How can we unlock the power of the cloud, bring that to the vehicle, and really improve the way it behaves?
Cool, that's interesting. Now, vehicle-to-vehicle communication, that sounds like a pretty hard one to tackle, because for that to work, in theory, you need all vehicles to have it, and you need all vehicles to be talking the same language in order to get some outcomes. So how would you be addressing those sorts of issues?
Well, you raised one of the number one issues, which is standards is really important. So the automakers are getting together, and they've defined a set of common messages, or it's a language essentially, so that the cars can talk to each other. And I think that's probably step one, is first we have to agree to a common language. The next piece is about equipping vehicles with this, right? We need a lot of people to have this in place so that we can cars can communicate with each other. And where the technology is now is we have cars, we have technology that we can demonstrate this on, and we're starting to investigate what does it look like if this is going to go across the broad range of vehicles. It's a big challenge.
And what do you see happening with the advances, sort of, GPS and location type technologies? What sort of improvements is that likely to bring over time?
Well, one thing that we're thinking about is how can we really personalize the vehicle? Because when you think about it, if you and I drive a car, we're going to use it in different places. We're going to go different areas. We're going to drive in a different way. And I think we can use this location and geo data to really improve not just sort of can you find your way to the store, but how can you drive along the way? Because if you can imagine, starting at the bottom of a hill and driving to the top of the hill is a much different trip than starting at the top of the hill and driving to the bottom of the hill. So if we have geo data, we can use that as information to improve the operation of the vehicle itself. You know, maybe we can change the way the engine works. Maybe we can change the way we use the electric motor in a hybrid. Those are areas that I think are really going to become important.
Great. Now, the vehicle, the hybrid that was launched earlier on in the week, that was interesting. They were talking about 100 miles to the gallon, I guess because of the plug-in capabilities, which I think worked out at about 2.35 litres per 100 kilometres for those of us on metric. Can you tell us, do you know a little bit about that technology and how that works and what we should expect to sort of see of that rolling out into other vehicles over time?
So the vehicle we launched was the Fusion Energy, and it's a plug-in hybrid vehicle. So it's kind of part electric vehicle and part hybrid vehicle. And what you do is you start your trip with a full battery, and then as you drive, you use up your battery. And when your battery gets low, or if you're driving in such a way that you need both your motor and your engine on, then the powertrain will automatically configure itself to give you the performance you need. And then after you drive and you deplete your battery, it operates just like a regular hybrid vehicle. You're able to collect energy from regenerative braking. You're able to turn the engine on and off and so on. So the plug-in capability comes at the end of the trip. When you get back to where you're going, you can plug it in and recharge it. So what you're doing is essentially using the energy in the battery before you use your gasoline energy. And that's a way to get much less fuel usage and potentially use renewable energy from the electrical grid.
Great. Now, one of the challenges with that is being able to plug in, having access to plug-in power, whether it's at home or elsewhere. Are there standards coming along in that space yet? Is it too early? Should we expect to see inductive charging type technologies where you just pull up at your car park and the vehicle could charge inductively? What should be coming down the track in that area?
So I think what we're focused on now is we all want to have a same charging port so that all the vehicles can have the same connection. Because when you go to the gas station, there's not a separate gas pump for each automaker. They all have the same interface. So through the Society of Automotive Engineers, the automakers are getting together and the suppliers to agree on a single interface. And that's probably the most important thing. There's also different types of charging. There's what we call convenience charging. And that's your basic wall outlet. So when you need to charge your mobile phone or, plug in a TV, that same electrical connector can be used to charge your vehicle. It takes a lot longer that way, but because it's a lower power, but that's always available to you. So even if there's not a high power connection around, you can always charge your vehicle that way. And then for the high power connection, you have a separate box that you install, you know, where you're going to charge your vehicle, that you can then plug in. And our Focus Electric vehicle downstairs takes about 3 hours to charge fully using the high power connection.
Great. And what's the power draw of that that high powered connection?
It operates at like a 220 volt level. I'm not exactly sure how many kilowatts it is, but it's significantly higher than the low voltage, the lower voltage one that that we plug in the convenience charger.
Right, and of course, in other markets like New Zealand, we're already operating on that 220 volt anyway. So does that mean that you don't need something special, or is it a higher level as well?
Yeah, it's a higher circuit because it charges at a much higher power level. So I imagine you can't just plug into a regular outlet. You need a special installation for it.
Right, but you'd still be able to charge potentially in a lower amount of time if you plugged into a wall outlet in New Zealand than US, maybe half the time, something like that?
You know, I'm not a charging expert. I'm not sure, so I'm not going to give you a difference in time. I'm just not sure about it.
Okay, that's fine. Yeah. All right. So anything else moving forward, anything else interesting from Ford that we should be keeping a watch for?
You know, I think it's not just about the technology you see down here today, but, I mean, we're really reaching forward and thinking about what's next. Ford's just not just an automotive company, we're really a technology company. And that's why we're here at CES to sort of showcase how automotive and consumer electronics are coming together.
Cool. Well, quite interesting to get some insights into where the technology's going as far as cars go. And, yeah, I mean, fascinating. I don't know how they're going to pull off this thing of having cars signaling to each other and how you can do that when most of the cars aren't. You know, how long does it take to change out all the cars that are in existence for new cars that chat to each other? I don't know how important that is in the scheme of things, particularly when we look at, you know, driverless cars that exist today. And, you know, of course, you've got the likes of Google and so on who have their vehicles that drive around for mapping purposes, and others doing similar things. What do you think about this?
Well, I mean, look at the two Fords we borrowed, that Ford New Zealand gave us to borrow, right? I mean, you know, we were having fun that night where we were leading at Parallel Park, but obviously the technology, the framework's getting built in there where it's understanding what's going on. I mean, it's got the crash test stuff there. It's probably a lot closer than we think in some ways. I think that, like you said, the biggest problem is getting that critical mass and all other pieces of technology out there.
Yeah. Well, if they're going to talk to each other, you've got to wait a long time. But yeah, as you said, you know, the vehicles we tried, they had those lane sensors. They could tell when you're moving in and out of
the crash
lane. They could, you know, they could tell when you're getting too close to a vehicle. And, you know, we tried out, some of those sort of features where using a cruise control, for instance, and, you know, just watches what's in front of you, make sure you follow at the appropriate distance. If someone's in your way, if they're not, then you just race off at whatever speed you've set. So, yeah, a good chunk of that technology is there. So I think this will be an area that we're going to follow more and more on the New Zealand Tech Podcast. And, you know, we'll be keen to hear feedback from listeners on their thoughts around this space. And we'll also be looking at other vehicles. And, of course, there were vehicles that we saw from Mercedes and Audi, Kia. There are a bunch of players now starting to innovate and really staying at the forefront of technology in vehicles. So we'll be reporting on more of that through the year as well. Now, next up, we had a chance to chat to Greg Sullivan from Microsoft. Now, he's involved in the Windows Phone team, so that was good to have a little bit of a chit chat with him and get some insights into what's happening in that space. And we asked him, you know, a range of questions around what's happening in the international and so on. So let's jump in with Greg Sullivan. Now, here at CES this year, it's been really interesting because for the past couple of years, you know, we've been hearing about Windows Phone, but there hasn't really been a lot of a buzz around Windows Phone to date, really, until probably this last week is really where the buzz seems to have set off, certainly here in the US, with Nokia's announcement around the Lumia 900, their first LTE phone, the HTC Titan 2, which is their first LTE phone. How's that for you? You've been involved in the Windows Phone business for about 5 years now, so it must be a bit of an interesting turn.
I don't want to seem too surprised, but it's certainly a pleasant happening. There's a tremendous amount of buzz around these new phones. I think when we made the Nokia announcement, people were really excited about the possibility of Nokia's hardware design and the elegant devices that they've built, bringing that expertise together with the software that we built, which has some of the same characteristics, real thoughtfulness in terms of the design, a simplicity and an elegance and a real usability. So folks have been excited for over a year now, or about a year now, to see the fruits of that relationship. And so when the Lumia 800 came out in Europe at the end of last year, it was very well received, and folks were real excited. So that excitement is building. And yeah, this is certainly one of the talks of the show. And in fact, the Lumia 900 won best in show in the smartphone category at CES this year. So it's really exciting, and it's a great start to what we think is going to be a great year.
Yeah, oh, congratulations on that best in show. That's really cool. Now, one of the conversations, or one of the issues where Windows Phone has struggled in the conversation in the marketplace has been around specifications of the actual hardware. One of the things I'm starting to notice is that the media sort of seem to be, and you know, this is sort of watching what's happening with you know, there's a fairly broad range of media covering CES. They seem to be sort of starting to get that story that the dual core and some of these other things aren't actually needed to deliver a great device that really works well when the software's right. Is that something you're starting to see a little bit of a change in as well, in terms of the perception, once people are seeing, for instance, the Lumia 900 and some of these other phones, they realize actually this is gorgeous and it actually works really well?
Yeah, well, we're certainly trying to make the point that the performance of your smartphone is what you can get done with it and how quickly you can get that done. And that's not necessarily directly related to the number of cores in number of CPU cores you have. In fact, oftentimes in our tests, the only result of having multiple CPU cores is your battery doesn't last as long. So we're doing a bunch of things to try and make the point that you should evaluate a smartphone not on a random number that the average person can't necessarily define, but on how it performs, how quickly you can get to the things that you want. How does it let you complete end-to-end scenarios? If you want to book a table at a restaurant and find a good one of a certain type nearby, how does your smartphone, which all of them can do that, they can do the discrete steps, right? They can analyze your location, search a database for nearby restaurants, provide mapping directions to it, have an application that lets you reserve a table. But no other platform connects that in an end-to-end experience the way a Windows Phone does. So regardless of how many cores in your CPU, what's more important is how quickly can you get things done. And that's one of the reasons why my buddy Ben, the PC guy here, has been running this $100 challenge all week at CES. And he's got a Windows Phone, and he'll go up to other folks who have other phones and say, hey, what do you like to do with your smartphone? Whether it's, you know, taking a picture and sharing it with your group of friends and posting it on social networks or whatever. And he'll ask that question, and based on the response, he'll challenge the person to a race to complete a task on a smartphone. And he's been doing this for several days now, and he did it a whole bunch of times. And what he's found is, the deal was that if you can beat him, you get $100.
Oh, that's nice. That's nice.
Yeah, it was a good deal. You know, it certainly got people's attention.
And can you enter that contest if you've got a Windows Phone and if you're faster on it than he is?
You know, I don't know if that's been tested. We might want to check that out.
Okay,
we can then parlay that at the blackjack table. But in any event, he's been getting a lot of attention with this, and one of the reasons is that people are beginning to realize that the design of the user experience in the software and the smartphone itself, how it integrates things, how it brings information to the surface and presents, you know, in Windows Phone, you search for a restaurant, we present the OpenTable application or another application that helps you reserve. It's aware of the context. So Ben's been doing this for a few days, and he's had tremendous success. He's had 30 victories and three times where he had to pay out the $100. So he was beaten three times, and I guess one of them was really close, and I think he tied in one. So 34 attempts and the $100 challenge, and Ben won 30 of them with Windows Phone. And he's got a real nice Windows Phone that he's using, but it's not about the cores and the CPU. Part of this is because when we launched Windows Phone, we worked with hardware manufacturers to define a very high-end phone. It's a quality piece of hardware, and it has a set of specifications that will always be high performance. And we've designed the system so that as you install and run more applications, it will continue to be high performant. And so that's why we feel confident that that we can go out and make that challenge. And Ben had a whole sack of $100 bills, and he only had to give away a couple of them.
Cool. Now, another question. There are some Windows phones that I haven't seen here on the show floor at CES, although they have been sort of flashed around. One would be the Fujitsu one that was released in the Japanese market. And I think there's also Acer and maybe Asus that have been bringing phones to market. Where are those ones at? Do you have any idea on their release and so on? I can't, you know, obviously some of that's been released, some of it's still coming through. And do you have any of those here for those of us who haven't seen them?
Yeah, I don't know that we have the Fujitsu phone. We have we're focused on, you know, this is a U.S. show. There's a lot of international attendance, but we don't have all of the what we call the phone operator pairings or the POPs. We don't have everything represented in our whole portfolio. We're at the point now where that's becoming a pretty big matrix, and we have a wide range of devices. And the focus for us really on this show has been the new devices that we just announced, the Nokia Lumia 900 and the HTC Titan 2. So we've really been kind of highlighting those this week. But we do have a broad range of devices, and some of those are limited in terms of their regional availability and not as kind of globally applicable. So they don't necessarily have as high a profile. But we're really excited about highlighting these two new phones that we've got this week.
Absolutely, great phones. Now, one of the things I've seen a little bit of discussion online about in the past couple of weeks has been around updates to Windows Phone. Now, this is an area where in general, as an operating system, it streets ahead of Android because every phone, you know, can get every update to a point. I'm sure there'll be a time when older phones aren't supported. But in the past, there was a matrix online that showed, you know, what was happening with all the different carriers and so on. Now that communication has changed a little bit. Is that something that Microsoft is open to sort of changing it back to how it was, or do you think the way forward we're going to see a little bit less information online around these the availability of these updates?
Well, we certainly want to be transparent and let people know what's going on as much as we can. I think the reason that table appeared in the first place was because we had some challenges with getting the Nodo release out, either alternatively the copy and paste or CDMA release, the one that shipped last spring. And it was a pretty protracted time frame, more protracted than we wanted. And folks began to be anxious and curious, rightfully so, about when that update was coming to their phone. So we started publishing the Where's My Update table in order to give people a better sense about when they could expect that. Now, in conjunction with that, we also, the engineering team, really refined and modified and worked on our update process, how we build and deliver updates. And so they were able to go from a situation with the Nodo release that was spanned over months before it was fully available to all the phones, to the Mango release, where we very, very quickly got, and I think in about 6 weeks, we got to about 98% of the install base and then got all the way to 100% in short order thereafter. So the table was really designed to help address that situation where it was taking a long time and people were anxious and wanted to know. For those big releases, and those were fairly significant, Mango certainly, feature releases. We're at the point now where we're delivering maintenance releases that have firmware updates that in some cases target only a specific device, and we're doing bug fixes and so forth. These are not big feature releases. That, in conjunction with the growth in our portfolio of the phone operator pairings, makes this matrix very, very big and kind of unwieldy. And it is true that not every update will go to every phone. So for these kind of maintenance releases, we're going away from publishing that table. It's something that we can revisit in the future. But I think if we're doing the job that we did on Mango, where virtually the entire install base gets that updated in very short order, then there's really less need for that that table to begin with. So,
okay, that's interesting. Now, one of the other areas that there's not so much information around is the next update, which it's been said is targeted at being able to bring lower end devices to market under the name Tango. And the things that I've heard this week commented on almost suggests that's a little bit of a different release to what's on these phones, so that our current phones aren't going to get Tango, but there'll be a slightly modified version that is targeting those lower end devices under that Tango code name. Does that mean there's sort of a slight split in the code? What can you get away with commenting on there? I know you're reasonably locked down on these sorts of topics.
Yeah, well, there's certainly a lot of speculation about what's going to happen, and we haven't made a lot of official comment on our roadmap. But what we have talked about is in general the idea of expanding the market applicability, the market reach of the Windows Phone platform, and that goes in a couple of dimensions. It means in new regions, in new languages, support for new network technologies that are required globally. So we'll continue to do that, and I can't get into any specifics on the delivery vehicle or the timing of that. But suffice it to say that we're going to continue to enhance the regional availability, the language support, the network technology supported in the platform. And at the same time, we've also talked about the idea that we'll increase the span of hardware capability, of hardware support, including support for things like the Qualcomm 7X27 microprocessor, which enables lower cost devices because of its lower bill of materials there. So I think it's those two things are true. We'll expand regional language network support. We'll expand the range of market segments that we address with our portfolio. The delivery vehicles I don't have details on for yet this time, but we can get into that more as we get closer. And then I think what's really important to keep in mind that the Windows Phone experience and the user interface and the promise that we make when we put the Windows logo on it is that it's going to have this core set of experiences. It's going to have the People Hub. It's going to have Xbox Live built in. It's going to have all the great apps in the marketplace. And you really won't have any sacrifices, even if you got buy a phone that's say today we've got phones for $49 and in some cases on special are available for free. We'll continue to have an affordable range of phones and some really kind of high-powered phones at the higher end of the market. What's different about our platform, though, is you don't make a lot of compromises. You don't give up a tremendous amount when you get a phone at the lower end that was more affordable. You still have a great core user experience. You may not have all the hardware characteristics. Your camera doesn't have as it's not as high resolution. Your screen is smaller. But the core experience is the same, which is why we'll put our free phone or our $49 phone up against the competition and compare very, very favorably. So we'll expand the reach, we'll expand the regions, we'll expand the languages, and then we'll expand the market segments that we address as well.
Okay. Now that you've I guess knocked off really most of the most of the shortcomings that the core Windows Phone has sort of had. You know, there's lots of apps out there now. I think over 50,000. Probably the most notable exception is Skype, which is really in your hands in Microsoft and Skype's hands together to do that. But in theory, with the acquisition, that should move along a little bit quicker. But there are, you know, some other shortcomings on that. And, you know, you were talking about international. You know, we don't have Zoom services in probably the majority of markets where Windows Phone's available. Although, you know, Zoom video has probably moved along quicker than the music. There's no podcast access, I think, probably outside of the US, which to me has always seemed like a bizarre one, because there should be no regional limitations around podcasts or copyright issues. Do you think those internationalization type things are going to start moving a lot quicker now that you've got so many other things out of the way? Would we expect to see a bit of sort of acceleration of progress in those areas?
Yeah, I think there's several reasons for that. One of which is what you just described. I think also as we continue to expand and have a greater presence internationally in regions that we even aren't in today, that will continue to become a higher priority for us. So one of the reasons that the Nokia deal in particular was so exciting for us is because of their expertise and presence internationally. It was exciting for them because with the partnership with us, I think they felt they had a really good chance to kind of reestablish in the United States and in North America. But I think their presence and their expertise internationally is going to help accelerate our presence and our regional appeal outside of the U.S. So one of the things that we'll be working closely with them on is how do we make available all of the services and all of the features that make a Windows Phone so compelling in regions all around the world? So that will become a higher priority.
Cool, that's excellent. Anything else you can add about what exciting things we should be expecting from Windows Phone over the coming year?
Well, I think this is a great start to 2012. These two phones that we announced here at CES, with the Lumia 900 winning Best of CES in the smartphone category, and the HTC Titan 2 just really blowing people's minds with its screen and its camera. It's really a harbinger of good things to come. This is going to be an exciting year for us, and we look forward to a lot more excitement and great new devices and support for the platform. Nokia's got some really great stuff coming. All of our partners are really bringing their A game, and we're really pleased to see that. So it's an exciting year. I know there's been a lot of anticipation of more information on the roadmap and future releases, and we've got folks in Redmond and in our R&D facilities around the world hard at work building those future products. And as we're ready and as the time is right, we'll look forward to sitting down with you and getting into more detail on that.
So yeah, that was interesting chatting with Greg. I guess one of the challenges I found at CES were that Microsoft and a lot of the other vendors were quite locked down in terms of the things that they could talk about. So I wasn't very successful in sort of squeezing confidential and non-announced information out of too many people, I'm afraid. But still good to have that chance to chat and to get some insights. Now, what we're moving on to next is really a wrap-up of CES, and one of the cool things at CES is just the sheer presence of people from the industry and also a lot of the key media players. And so we had guys there really from all of the big online magazines and print magazines, podcasts, TV. They were all there. Now, one of the guys I've really enjoyed hearing from in terms of commentary and so on online, reviews and podcasts in recent years is Joshua Topolsky, who was involved with heading up Engadget's content in the past, and recently, over the last sort of probably 6 to 9 months, has moved away from there, and they've recently launched The Verge. So let's now dive into a little chat that I had following the little after party that was put on by the guys from The Verge. At the end of CES, this is a chat with Joshua Topolsky, and partway through, Nilay Patel joins in as well.
You guys have been here all week, heaps of coverage.
Yeah.
What's been the most entertaining attempts at new technology and so on you've seen here, man?
Well, I don't know. It's hard to say how this falls under the entertaining banner, but the Justin Bieber robot, which doesn't make any sense to me whatsoever. It's like a dancing... It's not a Bieber bot. It's just a robot he's endorsing. Is bizarre and sort of pointless. It's got a speaker at its crotch. And I don't know what the market is for it. I know they must have paid him $20 million to come here and promote it. We've seen a lot of celebrity endorsements, like Dennis Rodman. Really kind of C-list people here.
Yeah, what's all that stuff about?
I don't know. I mean, I think that the technology industry is very impressed with if you've any celebrity at all. It seems like we get pretty crazy about it. And CES, you definitely see some of the more interesting, like Snooki. What is Snooki promoting? What has she been promoting?
Doesn't she have a show?
No, isn't she here promoting something? Like earphones or an MP3 player or...
Oh, I don't know. Snooki is she's not a person. She's a concept.
She's a virtualized...
Yeah.
She's a hologram.
She's the world's first real...
Snooki is actually a hologram. Avatar. You might not know this, but she's being projected into every space she enters. They were just trying to find something that could be... that would look weird enough that it wouldn't mess with the Uncanny Valley. So they made Snooki.
Yeah. It looks vaguely human,
And they sent Snooki to CES to be vaguely creepy and vaguely human. I don't know. What else?
Any other big fails? What about some of the 3D TV stuff? Some of that sort of
fail.
Work,
utter fail. I'm not going to name names. I saw some 3D TVs. You know what? Screw it. I'll name names. I went to the Toshiba booth. They're fine people. They make some fine products. But these glassless 3D.
Did you see the circles?
Yeah. The glassless 3D.
I couldn't wait that one out.
It just looks bad. It doesn't look good. It looks like a pixelated, like, nauseating mess. And I don't understand how they don't see that. I know it's a gimmick they're trying to sell a TV, but I think we could do better as an industry.
Yeah, I'm not sure that you guys went around and had a look at the other 3D
I looked at all of them.
This didn't seem to...
Failures always.
And the other fails are, I think, motion and voice control television, particularly the voice controlled one, because I don't know what scenario... I don't know where you're going to be, you know, particularly if you have a family in a perfectly quiet room to issue voice commands to your television. Also, it seems incredibly inefficient.
Well, it's hard enough for Microsoft to deliver, and they've been working on it for years, right? You've got these other guys that have come from nowhere and going, we're doing voice control.
Yeah, and you look at the biggest players, Microsoft and Apple and Google. Yeah. And they're just getting started with doing this stuff.
And they're doing it on their highest end devices.
And they're investing.
With real connectivity, real processors.
And they're making acquisitions and investing tons of money, and they still don't have it.
So to do it on TV with, like, no processor, no real connectivity, they're never going to get there.
It's very sad state of affairs. But there was some cool stuff.
There was definitely some cool stuff.
I like the Android TV box on an HDMI stick. Or MHL stick, rather. Which is like, hey, I've got an entire Android phone in here. I stick it in my TV, and now I can play games or watch Netflix or whatever. I think we're not quite there yet, but I love the idea of removing all cables and just having it stick in the side of the television. Or better yet, well, the problem with integrated is that it's always a worse experience. So I'm excited about that. And, you know, the Lumia 900 is pretty nice.
Yeah,
I mean, that was the thing of the show.
There's a Roku, isn't there, that's coming that's going to plug
the
in.
The Roku's going to do it.
Way,
it's MHL, same idea.
Yeah.
But in terms of products that were good, you didn't ask, but I'm telling you anyhow.
Yeah, no.
You have no choice in this matter. No, I think we widely agree. The Lumia 900 is you know, it's going to be the first. I think people are going to take it really seriously for Windows Phone here. It's a beautiful phone. We'll see if they can penetrate. It's going to be hard now.
So are you really going to use one? Are you going to try one now?
As soon as I get a review unit, I'll happily... I want to. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've used Windows Phone devices. This is not wildly different than any other Windows Phone device, but it's LTE. It's, you know, destined for America, and it's got a bigger display, which is nice, you know. So we'll see. I still have some issues with the apps. I think it's still not there. But I felt that way about Android a year or two ago. And now I think Android is a stellar platform. They still have app issues, but not nearly where they were. I think they'll get there. But the Vizio stuff was a big surprise, and I think a good surprise.
Yeah.
All the Ultrabooks were good because we want lighter, longer lasting, better made laptops. And that's...
Yeah, the thing about the Ultrabooks that's interesting is that it took Intel to say, we're doing it this way.
Yeah.
It's time. The industry didn't do it on its own. Intel pushed them to do it.
Yeah, and I... Go ahead, sorry. No, I was just going to say, well, the interesting thing is that, you know, speaking about Intel is that, and I think the story, the unwritten story, as of yet, though maybe I shouldn't say anything, is the subtle swap we're seeing in the industry now. And you heard me talking about it a little bit with Greg from Microsoft, of Intel becoming an Android platform, right? Android chips. And suddenly ARM is now for Windows. So you're seeing this swap of roles, and I don't know where that lands. Like, I don't know the end of that story yet.
Yeah,
I think it's really
clear,
interesting. They're both trying to be in the other one's space, and now you see a company like Qualcomm who can play in the Windows space, and that changes a lot.
Changes the devices. Intel hasn't had a real competitor for 7 years.
They've had AMD, but they've been kind of rolling along in the background.
They did it right there for a while, and then they just
tanked. Yeah, they made a lot of... the delays, and they had some issues with chips, so...
Yeah, I mean, AMD has been a competitor, but not such a visceral competitor. I mean, Intel was threatened.
Well, they were visceral at one point. They were in the game, and then they lost the game.
Yeah, but I don't think they've been in the game for five years.
Must have the most promise, because we've seen Windows come to other platforms and years gone by, right?
Yeah, the thing with ARM...
They were on PowerPC at one point. They've done crazy stuff.
The thing with ARM is that it's widespread. It speaks to the devices we're using now. You know, ARM is of the moment in every way, shape, and form. So when you start to think about where Windows goes in that environment, it changes what you think of Windows in general.
Well, every Windows system wants to be lower power, wants all of the things
well,
that ARM
I think Microsoft's, I think Microsoft's and, goal is to say, like, this isn't the Windows you know. You take it out, it's a tablet, you do everything you do with an iPad. You take it home, you dock, you do everything you do with a Windows PC. And that device will be attractive for a lot of people, I think.
Cool. Well, that was good to. It was good to get some other other thoughts and opinions really around the highs and lows, I guess, of CES. It's such a crazy show that no one person can really can catch it all, and so that's why we've plugged in an interview during the four podcasts we've done around CES. We've plugged into a lot of other people for their comments. So, I hope that's been helpful. How have you found hearing about CES from New Zealand, Brad? What are your thoughts?
Look, I mean, I really enjoyed the Joshua one. I think he pulled together an exact sort of picture of what CES was about this year. I mean, Justin Bieber robot speaker thing was hilarious. You know, and it's great. I love listening to Joshua. He's a very, very interesting man. But from this side of the world, it just felt really ho-hum. And I think we spoke about this when we were on talking to you in Vegas. It just, there was a bit of flatness coming out of it. I think from my perspective, Ultrabooks dominated all the media reports with a close second. Windows Phone 7 this time around, for me, was seen to get a lot of positive media. Whether it's going to take off, we don't know.
Absolutely, and that was what I saw. Most of the biggest media attention was really around Nokia's announcements on Windows Phone. Those were the big things, and you know, I was seeing top 10 lists and a lot of media coverage highlighting the best of CES, and a lot of those right at the top was Nokia with their Lumia 900 Windows Phone. There were also the announcements around the HTC Titan 2.
Yep.
Those were, you know, I saw both of those phones often in the top 10 of CES. So this is I think that's a real coup for Microsoft to have landed Windows Phone in this space where now, hey, people were saying this is the best of the best that was at the show. And, you know, if we look back at the introduction of Windows Phone, everyone said, yeah, this looks nice and it's beautiful, etc. But it didn't really get a whole lot of attention, whereas now it's at that place where I think it's ready for the mass market, and really we saw that in terms of the attention at CES that it gained.
All right, so for me, one of the biggest fails from what I've read about CES has been all the 3D stuff. I'm still not a fan of 3D. I know you and I have debated this one off air quite a bit, but I'm still not there that it's a it's something that I'm going to go out and purchase in my next TV.
Well, the discussion we've had on it before is for the foreseeable future, if you've got a 3D setup, the 3D content you watch will only ever be will only for the foreseeable future be a low percentage of the content that you view.
Yep, exactly.
So, you know, you've got to weigh up what the value is in doing that. And there's always going to be a sector of our audience and of the market that will want to have the latest and greatest.
So but, what for you, though, was the biggest fail of the whole CES? Come
ooh,
on. You, come
that,
on.
That's a, that is a, that's a really good question. I think, you know, for me, one of the letdowns, and, you know, we knew this up front, was that Microsoft didn't have a whole lot of new stuff to show at CES. That was a pity. But, yeah, as I've said before, Microsoft said up front, look, we're not announcing new products at CES. And so they weren't able to show off a whole lot of stuff. But on the flip side of that, what we did get to see was a sneak peek at what appear to be some of the new Windows 8 devices, but the vendors weren't able to say. And, you know, again, we saw some really cool devices from the likes of Sony and Toshiba and others. Actually, not Toshiba, I might have got that one wrong. But, yeah, we saw some nice devices that are coming through that are likely to be Windows 8 devices. So, I was hopeful to see more info, but, you know, we knew that the chances were reasonably slim on that. There was, I guess, Android had a lot of presence at CES, was interesting. Just there were devices all over the place from all sorts of obscure manufacturers, from the likes of Kobe and Hire. Hire had their little Hi Pads, they called them. I thought that name
was
an absolute fail. It was just, what a joke. But there was all sorts of stuff. And, yes, some of those Android devices were just so poor. They talked about high-end specs, and then you try them out, and they were really laggy. There was a lot of sort of cheaper products across the show floor that were just not up to the fit and the finish of what the bigger vendors are delivering. And I guess that's one of the that's one of the issues that exists with making a product for available to a broad audience without drawing lines around specifications and having a whole lot of standards around how things are built. Now, one last product that I did come across out at CES that I haven't mentioned before. Now
he's reaching into his pocket. He's going to show me something here.
Now I'm reaching into my pocket to see if I can find the photos that I took. Now this is a new brand that is coming out of, get this, Australia. So this is a product from down under, and the company,
is this waterproofing one that you're going on about?
No, this is something different. This is a company that is going to release PCs, laptops and tablets. So it's a new PC vendor. Now, how often did new PC vendors come along? Not too often, unless they're, you know, a little company out of, Taiwan or China or something. So, I got to have a look at some of their early and pre-release products, which were actually looking pretty cool. So, just give me a moment, and I'm going to tell you what the name of them is.
It's interesting that, I mean, someone like Australia is actually going to start producing, because, I mean, you have your little white box manufacturers in every country, but if these guys are going to go a little bit larger than that, that's a big step for the Australasian area.
Yeah, so what's going to happen in this case is the products are going to be produced in Taiwan, but they're all being designed in Australia, and they've got an engineering team in Taiwan as well. One of the things I found fascinating was they said they originally looked at Chinese manufacturing because the bulk of these things is has moved over the last 10 years from being made in Taiwan to being made in China. But what they found was that the quality of the product made in China just wasn't up there with what was made in Taiwan, which was fascinating. So the company name I was looking for is Evolve 3, and their evolve3i.com is the website. And yeah, have a look there. One of the things that I was quite impressed by was their tablet. Now at the moment that was I think running a pre-release version of Windows 8, and it was 560 grams.
Wow.
And they're saying when it comes out it's going to be lower. Now this is an Intel based device, I think it's Atom based, and they are more than likely also going to be bringing ARM devices to the market, and those should be able to bring that down even more. So yeah, very nice devices. Great to see something coming new coming out into the market down under, and we'll be looking forward to hearing more of their story, and we'll probably get our hands on with some of their products over the next couple of months as well.
So that's CES, Paul. You've done it.
That's it. That's a wrap. There are a few other bits and pieces and topics which we'll chat about on you know, coming shows,
yeah,
that have come out of CES, and some of the other questions that you even raised during CES that I'll try and answer, and you know, we'll keep in touch with some of these companies as well for more during the year. Excellent. Hey, thanks everyone for listening in to all. I hope you caught all four of our episodes on CES, if I've got that right. About four episodes, maybe more. Man, losing count now. Please check us out online if you haven't already. nztechpodcast.com. Of course, we're facebook.com/nztechpodcast. Or if you're listening in, one of our American guests listening in, it'll be nztechpodcast.
That's so bad.
And Twitter. NZ Tech Podcast on Twitter. So thanks very much, everyone. Do email us as well if you've got feedback at nztechpodcast.com. Now, you can catch Brad on Twitter. Your handle is?
At Brad Bohr.
And my handle, just my name, Paul Spain. So thanks everyone, and we'll catch you on the next episode of the NZ Tech Podcast.
See you, everyone. Bye.
Bye.